To me, family means someone that you can always rely on and go back to. If anyone's let you down in life, then they'll always be there for you no matter what.
A girl's home should be her ultimate safe space, an environment without fear or judgment. The average child will have spent only around 9% of their life in school by the time they're 18 years old. So that leaves an enormous amount of time for caregivers to shape their values and their mindsets in the home.
They also set boundaries for you to try and be the best possible version of yourself. They're also great role models for any part of your life. Like, if you were aspiring in a particular career in your future, they'll always push you to do that rather than just give up and fail.
So what role do girls end up playing in the family as a result? Peacemaker? High achiever? Listener? Rule follower? And do those roles actually help them find their voice and show up authentically as adults? I'm Trudy Hall, host of The Connected Girl, a podcast series produced by the International Coalition of Girls' Schools. In this season of The Connected Girl, we're looking more closely at agency. How can an adult nurture confidence in girls about their own actions and decisions while allowing them to experiment, evolve, and sometimes fail? Today, we're joined by Dr. Katie Hurley, Vice President of Community Initiatives for the Jed Foundation, a leading nonprofit that protects emotional health and prevents suicide for teens and young adults nationwide. She's the author of 5 books at the intersection of youth, parenting, and mental health, including the award-winning No More Mean Girls. Through her private practice, advocacy, and educational talks, Katie is dedicated to promoting the mental health of tweens, teens, and young adults. Thank you for joining us today, Katie.
Thank you so much for having me.
I think we ought to give folks a bit of context for the good work that you do with the Jed Foundation. Can you give us a quick summary of what the Jed Foundation does?
The Jed Foundation is a leading nonprofit that protects the mental health of and prevents suicide for youth and young adults in America and abroad. And we do this by creating mental health safety nets in schools at all different levels, universities, high schools, districts, and in community-based organizations.
Very important work, particularly with given what we know about the statistics in that regard. But let's dive in a bit deeper on our topic now and talk about girls specifically and their home lives, a topic you know a lot about. According to your experience and research, how are girls often socialized to show up in families or within the home?
Well, this can go in any number of ways. And it's always important to remember different cultures have different practices around how kids are raised and particularly how girls are raised. One thing we see over and over again is girls are often socialized to be polite, responsible, hardworking, and to sort of just listen to authority. Not to say that we're trying to raise kids who don't listen to authority whatsoever, but girls are often socialized to do exactly as they're told and not really push back. So they don't learn how to say no or set boundaries at a young age.
So if you think about that, then that's what you would argue is that's a role that a parent can actually step into in a different way. Are there suggestions for how we might help them set boundaries?
Yeah. So one thing I say to parents a lot is to really think about how we talk to girls about all of these different pieces. So it's really important for girls to get lessons early on and then repeatedly as they grow, because we know as kids grow and change and their brains develop and change over time, they encounter lots of different stressors and things. And sometimes those skills just need extra work during those times of transition. But what I talk a lot about is empowerment. So coming from a place of letting young girls know early and often that they are allowed to say no to things that make them uncomfortable or that they don't want to do. They're allowed to set boundaries around how they spend their time. You know, kids today are growing up in a world where they're in school 6+ hours a day, and then they're often doing lots of extras after school, whether it's on their school campus or something in their community. They need to be able to protect their own downtime. So on weekends or if there happens to be an after-school day where they have a couple of hours, they need to learn how to fill those hours on their own. And learning to do that is part of setting boundaries and saying, this is who I am, and this is what I want to do with my time. So those are sort of important primers, but also just being able to push back a little bit. So kids learn how to engage in healthy conflict at home. And so being able to say, no, thanks, I don't want to do that right now. Or, you know, talk about the why of something that a parent wants them to do, whether it's going to a big birthday party and they don't like big birthday parties, or engaging in yet another activity and they're just feeling like, no, I have too many activities. Really giving them voice and listening to them and responding in a calm and thoughtful manner helps them learn how to speak up for themselves later on.
So we're thinking a lot about, you know, speaking up for yourself and empowerment, which is a lot about building an identity for yourself. How do we allow girls to stand up for themselves if the questions are sort of things like helping around the house? You know, it's time to take out the garbage. I mean, I hear what you are saying and it sounds really practical and I like it. And we all know as parents, there are moments when it doesn't matter. We need to get to the school bus or whatever. So how is there an age at which we start to language differently? What does that look like?
Sure. So first of all, when we talk about helping around the house, I think, you know, we get so focused on the word chores and we, you know, chore charts and lists and like all things. And all of this comes from a good place of like, let's get it organized, right? I always say, let's just talk about, we all live here together. We all pitch in. So we all have a role to play. It takes the pressure off. And honestly, even just like not using the word chores can help in like, hey, who's a helper right now? Who can help me with this? Who can help me with that? So just engaging them in a more collaborative way from the start empowers kids to like, oh yeah, I can do this. And if you spend any time in a preschool, you will see this exactly happening. So hey, who's in charge of helping me set the table? Hey, who's in charge of helping me do this? Who's sweeping today? You know, so teachers always engage in a, where are my helpers? And, you know, what are my helpers doing today? Bringing that into the home is actually brilliant because it gives them some ownership, right? Some onus over, this is your space too, and you have to take care of it and you have to help take care of it. I mean, in terms of language, I think the trouble we get into as parents, and I say this as a parent, the trouble we get into as parents is we're often running low on time. Time is the thing we have the least of. And so we're barking out orders to get to the car, to get to the place on time. And that place can be school or work or both or some sort of meeting. So building more time into your day, as simple as that sounds, can be actually just a really helpful strategy. I find my best days are when I get up 40 minutes before anyone else in my house. I have my coffee. I read the news that I want to read. I get myself planned. I get myself organized so that I'm not racing against the clock. Because if I'm racing against the clock, my kids will be too.
They'll feel it. They'll feel your attention as well. It's funny you say that because I do think it's one of the easiest solutions. And yet we know in our lives, it's one of the hardest solutions to get yourself out of bed and get yourself organized just a little bit earlier when you've got kids, right? But speaking of the things you do with kids, when you and I were talking, getting ready for this interview, you introduced a really interesting phrase. You know, we talk about a lot about getting girls in a position where they can advocate for themselves, where they can set boundaries, where they can, you know, establish an identity through the kinds of language they use. But you talked about co-advocacy. Can you explain what that is and how it might be used by a parent or in working with a child?
Yes. Thank you for reminding me of this phrase. So co-advocacy is huge in a variety of ways. And I'll give you a specific example of how I practiced this with my daughter when she was very young. But the purpose of co-advocacy is to kind of scaffold this skill. It's unreasonable to ask children and even sometimes teenagers to advocate for themselves every single time, because in every space they enter, there's a power differential between the person they are speaking to try to change something and themselves. And so they're always the powerless one in the room, almost always. And they feel that and they know that. And, you know, we expect even like a 16-year-old to be able to go to a teacher and advocate for their needs around, you know, maybe their learning differences or things like that. It's really hard to do that when you know that the teacher holds the key to the A or the B, the C or the D. So when we advocate with them, not for them, but with them, when we help them practice, when we walk in with them, even if we have no intention of even saying a word, but we're just providing support. We stand outside the door when they go in after all that practice to advocate with their coach or teacher. Our presence alone gives them a sense of both relational safety and empowerment, where they feel like, okay, my person is here, I can do this. When they're really young, I say, do this with girls as often as possible. And so you'll hear experts all the time say, kids should order for themselves at restaurants from the minute that they can speak. Again, this is a hard thing to do, partially because it's loud, it's confusing. Sometimes people ask questions in return and that can feel stressful. So with them, so helping them voice it, you know, giving them a little bit of a nudge on like, oh, did you say that you wanted sweet potato fries instead of regular French fries? Is that, did you say that? You know, so asking questions and engaging with them to kind of help them speak up is co-advocacy. Being there with them, scaffolding the skill, teaching them how you may say it, but then saying, wait, how would a kid say this? Wait, how would you say this in your voice? Because I'm talking like me. Let's talk like you. Tell me how to say it in your voice. That just gives them skills practice. So when my daughter was young, she was loud at home, quiet out in the world. And so people would say, she's so shy. And I would be like, oh my God, she never stops talking, right? Because from all day, every day, talking, talking, talking. And she still does that. So when we would go to, I would take her to places that are like emotionally safe places, like the public library is always a great place to start working on advocacy and speaking up and, you know, getting needs met. And so we would go to the public library, to the children's, you know, section. And she would be like, oh, I really want a book on some very highly specific kind of whale or something. And I would be like, okay, well, I think the science books are over here, but let's think about it. Let's look. Huh, what should we ask a librarian if we were going to ask for this book? Because I don't, you know what? I don't know as much about these whales. What are you looking for? What do you want to ask? And we would practice the question, and then she would go up and ask the librarian for help. So that's co-advocacy. I'm helping her work on the skill, build the skill, practice the skill, and then she goes and executes, but I'm nearby in case she just needs that feeling of safety. We do this all the way through, you know? So even when they're teenagers, helping them navigate conflicts with peers in romantic relationships, just helping girls learn how to say what they need to say is really, really important because in this world, girls are still conditioned to meet the needs of other people first. They are still told repeatedly through societal messaging that they are the caretakers for people, and we have to help them become the caretakers for themselves.
That was terrific because you gave us some opportunities to think about verbal skills. What about nonverbal behavior? Sometimes that can be even more important than the words that come out of our mouth. What can the behavior of a girl tell us?
You know, when we look at patterns of behavior, and if you look in the classroom, so this is a good example. If you look in the American classroom, girls have been outperforming boys in the classroom since the 1930s. That has not changed. Boys have been out talking and out posturing in that exact same time frame. So they use their bodies, they use their eye contact because they're built to be confident, to show confidence, not just to say it, you know, not just to use their words, but to use their body posturing, straight backs, right? You know, upright, make eye contact, smile a lot, like look interested. They're taught all of these skills where girls, if you look around a classroom, they'll be rapt with attention. They'll look ahead, they'll pay attention, they'll take way more notes. They're very studious and they'll take way more notes, you know, but sometimes when a teacher starts bouncing a question to the classroom, you'll start to see eyes go down. If they're not 100% sure that they know an answer, they're not going to answer. Now, boys are going to raise their hands and say something nonsensical just to say something, not every time, but they will do that. Where girls, if they don't know, they are not going to answer and they're going to look down and wait and hope they don't get called on. So, you know, teaching girls, what is assertive nonverbal communication? Well, it is, you know, eye contact. Now, for some people, eye contact is not a possibility. We all have different brains. We all have different neurological processes. And so straight eye-to-eye contact can feel overwhelming, intimidating, and not possible. So I often teach girls to get into the habit of looking to someone's ear. Like if you look just to the side of a person, now we're on Zoom, so you can't see me doing it, but I'm looking right to one of your headphones right now. You look right to the side. It looks like you're making that eye contact, but you're actually giving yourself that emotional space. So sometimes looking right into someone's eyes can feel very stressful, but looking just to the side can still give that confidence in that I'm listening, I'm talking, but I'm protecting my emotional space by just shifting my gaze slightly off to the left. I have taught girls who need to do that to say that. Like, if it looks like I'm not looking in your eyes, I'm just looking right next to you because that's how I feel most confident. It's okay to say that, right? It's okay to call out what we need to do to be confident, but also teaching them that even if you don't know an answer to something, you can still make eye contact. You can hold your body up straight, right? You can uncross your arms. People cross their arms for a lot of reasons. And I do it a lot. And people will say like, oh, you're guarded. And I'm like, I'm the least guarded person I know. I do it for comfort, but I've learned to do this, to like put my hands together and just hold my hands together, you know, at my waist, because that gives me that same sort of comfort level while I'm speaking. So teaching girls these kind of nonverbals, also that you can get help from a teacher nonverbally. So you can look at a teacher and kind of like make your eyes a little wide. And that shows a teacher like, hey, I might need some help right now, or I'm thinking about something and I need help. You can go to a teacher in between classes and say, when I get overwhelmed, can I wink at you and you'll come help me? Or can I, you know, hold up a peace sign and you'll come to my desk and tap on my desk? So there are all kinds of ways to use our nonverbal skills to connect with people. The problem is girls are often taught to be demure. So look down, look like you're listening, respond when you're spoken to. That's not how we teach boys. And I have a boy and a girl, and they don't get the same lessons from society. And so really, I mean, I have spent 19 years teaching my girl to take up space, both verbally and non-verbally. And she has learned how to do it, but it was a process. And there's pushback along the way because not everybody does that. So my best tip is teach girls how to take up space out of the gate.
And that's a great visual. Teach girls how to take up space. You can imagine her just getting bigger, shoulders back, arms out, face up. I like that visual. And I can imagine some fun games around the dinner table as you're teaching girls how to take up space. 2015, you published The Happy Kid Handbook, How to Raise Joyful Children in a Stressful World. I think we can probably all agree that the world hasn't become any easier since you wrote this book. So now, what advice might you add, given that it's a full decade later?
Oh, so many things. You know, when I wrote that book, yes, the world was hard and education was changing rapidly. Expectations were growing in terms of being able to read heading into kindergarten versus taking kindergarten and first grade to learn how to read, you know? So there were all these sort of changes that were happening. This was the very beginning of super kids, where, you know, basically childhood became monetized and playing a not just a developmental sport, but a club sport at age 5, 6 became essential in the minds of American parents everywhere. Not our fault. We were fed a steady diet of this is what it takes. I remember sitting in my daughter's kindergarten classroom at that time, hearing a teacher say, and I love my kindergarten teacher, oh my goodness, she's the best person in the universe, but hearing her kind of recite the words that she's given, you know, college and career ready came out of her mouth at one point. And I was like, this child is 5, you know, so it was such a funny, like, and we would have funny conversations about that behind the scenes. And so that was kind of that increasing stress level. And then the world got harder. And since then, countless school shootings in America. Things are upside down right now. People don't feel safe. So what would I change? It's a big question. And I think I would start with really holding space for kids to talk about what they're hearing. But I think really just holding space, you know, bringing back larger chunks of family time, board games, you know, playing board games on a Friday night, you know, board games and pizza and a movie. Not everything has to be a sleepover or a play date. Kids consistently say in surveys that they crave family time. They want to be with their families. They want to talk to their grown-ups about hard things. Their grown-ups are busy. Their grown-ups are on their phones. Their grown-ups are so stressed that they're checking all the notifications. This, again, all of this comes from a good place, right? Like, we want to know what's going on in the world because we want to help in the way that we can, or we want to just be educated and aware. We have to be educated and aware about how our behaviors affect our children. And so really carving out time, bringing back that space, bringing back times where a play date was just showing up at someone's house or meeting up in a park and just figuring out what to do. We are so scripted right now. And what children need more than anything in times of high stress is free, unstructured play. The ability to play on their own terms and play what they want to play and navigate that with their friends.
As you mentioned, sometimes adults just want to jump in and they want to do the problem solving. Maybe my child's bored. Maybe they need another activity. You know, that might not be the best move all the time. And so any tips for our parents when, you know, they need to figure out when it's good to jump in or when it's good to just get out of the way?
Well, first of all, if a kid comes to you with a problem, I always say, ask the following question first. Do you need support or solutions? 9 out of 10, they're going to choose support. They want you to listen as they walk themselves through it, because kids will talk themselves through being super frustrated. And then you hear their voice start to calm. And then they start to think about what to do. And as they're like verbalizing all of that, they'll solve most of their own problems. I find that over and over again across age groups. People need to vent. We do it as adults. We call our spouse, we call a friend, a sister, a sibling, and we vent. And we don't want them to solve our problem. We just want them to go, oh yeah, that stinks. Well, kids want the same thing. So that's number one, is when they come to you, ask that question and then lean into empathy first before you jump into problem solving. I'm the worst. I always say I'm the worst. I've got 75 solutions to every problem and I have to sit there and close my mouth and remind myself in my brain, I'm here to listen. I'm here to listen. So, you know, developing a mantra that stops you from jumping in is essential. If you're seeing siblings argue or kids argue, honestly, they have to learn to settle conflict. Now, if they're screaming at each other and it's super unproductive, you want to approach them and say, it sounds like you're having a hard time. Let's all take a deep breath for a minute and then take turns kind of describing the problem and describing the solutions. So you're not giving them the solutions. You're just kind of guiding them toward, let's calm down first. And then you can take turns talking so you can hear each other better. But let them do the talking, you know, let them brainstorm the solutions, because kids know on kid level what they need to solve a problem. We just often don't let them work through to that place because we're uncomfortable or we think they're so uncomfortable. They're usually not. I mean, that's an example of kids advocating for themselves. They may be doing it too loudly or not in the most polite way, but they're actually trying to voice their needs. And if we interrupt that too much, then we send the message that it's not okay to do that. So we want to always be careful about how and when we intervene, giving kids kind of that space to handle hard things. And like they come to you and say, this isn't working. I can't do this. Again, it's like, you know what? When I'm super frustrated, something that helps me is to go just stand outside for 5 minutes and look around and then come back in with fresh eyes. Should we try that? I'll go with you, you know, or, you know, something like that. Or sometimes it helps me to just distract myself with something for like 5 minutes. And then I come back and I find that usually I can figure out the solution. So really giving them like, what are your strategies? And then you could kick it back to them and say like, do you think that would help you? Or would something else help you? What would help you to kind of calm your brain for a minute so that you can come back to it? And then when they're bored, you know, I always kick back with, yeah, being bored is hard. So what do you want to do when you're bored? What can you do? What do you have? What's in your room? What's downstairs? What's outside? You know, like just cue them with questions, but don't give them what to do because they have to figure it out. I mean, being bored is one of our best skills. Being bored is when we humans actually do our best thinking because we don't have competing demands clogging our thoughts. So kicking it back to them and kind of encouraging them to solve their own boredom gets them into the habit of listening to their brains and knowing that, actually, this is space where I can figure things out.
So now we're going to take this wonderfully well-adapted child who, you know, has her space, knows her boundaries, has grown up in your household, is really well-adapted, and she's going to head on out into the world. There she is, and she hits a situation that is not really necessarily in the same lane as the way your family operates. She's going to bump into stuff. What's a parent to do in that moment when she bumps into these outside forces that don't do things the way you do in your home?
We did a lot of this, especially in middle and high school. This happened to my daughter just a lot. And I will say the single biggest thing she was up against was we very deliberately raised our kids with empathy first and with sort of a social justice mindset of like, turn around and think of who's behind you. Who can you help? And both of our kids, you know, were raised in this way, not just our daughter. But when our daughter went out into girl world on her own, away from us as anchors, it became really evident that not a lot of other girls had been raised that way. And so the language that would be used, the decisions that were made, she often got tagged as the quote, good girl. And she despised that label because she felt like it pushed her down, when really she felt like she was a person who, you know, was thoughtful and caring and helpful and empathetic and all those, and compassionate, all those good things. She also, and to this day, she's still navigating this, she became everybody's therapist. So girls quickly realized she was never going to engage in any of the mean girl stuff, but she would listen when it happened to them. And so she carried the burden of other girls on her shoulders. And we had to rework, what does it mean to be assertive in a self-care capacity? Because she almost, not that she lost her assertiveness skills, but she didn't know how to manage it with girls who were dumping on her all the time. And then sometimes they were turning on her, you know, and like, you know, they would say things to her like, oh, you're going to tell on us, or like, you're the one who tat. Like, there were a couple times where groups of girls completely iced her out, accusing her of being someone who tattled, which she never did. Like, she really didn't do that. And that was because they perceived her to be the quote, good girl. And so she got left out of things, and it was hard to navigate. And so part of it was letting her figure out, like, okay, what is your voice at this age? So we knew what your voice was at age 10, 11, and it worked. Now you're a teenager, you're up against different choices, different stressors. Like, you can go to a party and not drink. You're not in charge of other people, whether they make that decision or not. And you don't even have to give them input, but you need to do what's right for you. But how do you navigate it when then people make fun of you because they feel uncomfortable because you're not doing it, right? You're not joining in. So that increases their discomfort. We really had to practice a lot together. And then she would kind of call or text her older cousins. She has two older female cousins. I really believe having mentors that are just a little bit older than you, like social mentors, I call them, it's like gold, because they can listen. They can empathize. They totally get it because they've been through it. I mean, I can get it. You know, I grew up girl, right? But I didn't grow up girl in a world of digital technology, in a world of competing demands that are just instant. So they're able to sort of mentor her a little better and say, like, this is what I wished I had done. This is what didn't work for me. Let's think about what might work for you. So that's one thing, is kind of pairing them off with some older girls to help them navigate. But then really just being able to listen, be a sounding board. If you can listen without solving, they'll come to you. And it's uncomfortable. And you are going to hear all kinds of things you don't want to hear and you don't like. And you're going to have to bite your tongue and think, like, why are you choosing this group? They have no values. But, you know, there are going to be times when you feel that way. And it's hard, you know, and it's hard to stay out of it if you're friends with the parents. It's really hard to bite your tongue and not say, I really wish, you know, that our girls could be together in this. But we have to. We have to learn to decenter ourselves as they do the work of navigating these tricky situations. And we got to be there to just be the soft landing when they fall. They're going to fall. They're going to have times when they come home in tears. And all we can really do is open our arms, listen, hug them through it.
You can imagine that the stakes are low if you're practicing, particularly if you're practicing, you know, with your mom, and your mom is someone who does listen and who doesn't jump to conclusions, you know. And I think it's that whole idea of engaging with their problem solving in a way that lets them hear out loud, oh, that didn't sound so good, I better try something else. So I think that's a good notion to hang on to as well. You know, as we think about the road these young people are traveling now, I want to go back a moment to the Jed Foundation, because it is dedicated to young adult mental health and suicide prevention. And we know that is critically important work in this day and age. So this is probably a very unfair question, but what's the one thing you wish that all caregivers and parents of girls knew in this realm of suicide prevention?
That it's okay to ask them if they're having thoughts of suicide, that that won't put thoughts in their head, that they've already heard about it, they've already been exposed to thinking and talking about this sort of thing, and that not every thought of suicide leads to action, but each time we talk openly and honestly about it with them, we help them to figure out a different solution to their problem.
Nice and concrete. Thank you very much. So in this season of The Connected Girl, we're also leaning into the idea that we got to let go of perfectionism, not just for our girls, but for ourselves. And so we know how important it is, you know, to leave room for the mistakes and to model that for kids. What do you say to a listener now who's hearing you, likes your advice, but knows, wow, I've been missing the mark. I have not been doing this. How do you help them step away from their own need for perfectionism as a parent?
Well, first of all, I would just like to state for the record that I have missed the mark. So everybody misses the mark. And I don't want to come off as someone who's saying, if you just do these 10 things, your kid will be perfect and your life will be perfect, because that's just not how it works. Life is messy. And you know what? Sometimes the best parts are the messy parts in the end. You know, you do a lot of connecting and working together in the messy parts. So I am currently researching my next book, which is on girls and, you know, helping them actually on girls in collaborative leadership. So that's the only hint I'm going to give. But I'm knee deep in research and reading all of the current research on this. And I just want parents to know that perfectionism is very slowly killing us. It's harming us in ways that we don't think about. And humans are wonderfully flawed individuals. I think that's good. Learning how to make peace with, you know, where we do miss the mark sometimes, and then lean into someone who can help us through that piece of our lives, that's just essential learning. So I say this to the college-aged girls that I work with all the time, because it's high pressure in college, and they feel like they're in this space where they're supposed to have their lives figured out, and they don't. And I'm always like, no, that's why you're in college. You have 4 years to figure it out, you know, but they don't feel that way anymore. They feel like they're supposed to come in having it figured out, know what's going to happen, follow a plan, and get that perfect job, right? And it doesn't work that way. Life never works that way. And so I say to them all the time, like, if you have a strength and then you have another area that you deem as like your weakness or something that you struggle with, find the girl that can help you with your weakness and then share your strength with another girl. This is how women will succeed. We know this. When we get old like us, we know that the only way for young women to succeed is to pool their strengths, work together, and lift each other up. You know, rising tide lifts all boats. We know that when we're old. They never know that in the younger years, in the teen years. They know it when they're little. So in elementary school, by God, do they do that, right? And then they get to middle school and the competition starts and the perfectionism starts and the not wanting to be wrong and wanting to know the perfect answer before they raise their hand, all that stuff. What we can do from a young age is talk about our own failures, our own mistakes. Just this morning, my husband and I were navigating the refrigerator at the same time as I was working on something in the background. And I pulled out the eggs and an egg flew out and fell on the ground and cracked right on the hardwood floor, right? And neither of us, we laughed. I mean, neither of us got mad or upset or like, and neither of us even said sorry. It was just like, well, isn't this just the perfect metaphor for a morning, a gloomy morning in Los Angeles? And our son was standing nearby, you know, and that's a lesson for him that, like, you know what? Eggs crack. And you know what you do? You clean it up together. You move on. You know, you help each other out. You move on. You get on with your day. We've got to send that message across the board. Grades are not that important. Grade portals have stressed out parents to a degree that is really untenable and unfair. I never look at my son's grade portal. I actually got in trouble for not signing up for it this year, so I finally did. But I don't look at it. It's his business. If he is struggling, I trust him to come to me. If he doesn't, I trust someone at that school to come to me and say, hey, your son is struggling. If they don't, we're going to have problems. But I'm not going to hypermanage my kids, because they have got to learn that it's okay. You know what? It's okay. Sometimes we don't do as well in a class as we thought. It doesn't mean anything. It doesn't ruin our future. There's all kinds of paths to the future. So we really, the only thing we can do about perfectionism is undo it and not make it cool. It is not cool to try to be perfect. It is anxiety.
I love it. Undo perfectionism. We can do this one day at a time, right? I really am enjoying this conversation. Unfortunately, we do have to wrap it up. You have given us so many great pearls of wisdom. Do you want to end with a few more, or you got so much to offer? How would you like to end this podcast?
I think I would like to end this podcast by saying that it can be really difficult to raise girls in this world. There are so many pressures and threats around every corner, it feels like, and things to keep up with in terms of social media and AI and all the things that they're enmeshed in that we're like chasing them, trying to learn about as they flawlessly enter the world of technology. The best thing we can do is focus on our relational safety, hold their hands, and walk through it with them and ask a lot of questions.
I want to thank you so much for giving us some great language around co-advocacy, the idea that we should be with our kids, not act for them, but help them with the problem solving. Huge difference in how to think about that. And holding space for them to be the people they need to be, particularly in our family environments. I love that being bored is a skill. I love it. Absolutely. In this day and age, I think it's one of the best things, one of the best skills we can teach our kids. And I really enjoyed the notion of having you share with us the ways in which you parented your own children, because I think there's a lot to be learned from that, particularly because we aren't perfect and sometimes we do drop the eggs. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to The Connected Girl, a podcast produced by the International Coalition of Girls' Schools to address real issues that impact the lives of girls we know. This series engages listeners to think about how girls can take up space, belong, and feel valued in the world. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to The Connected Girl on the ICGS's podcast channel on educating girls so you can check out the rest of the series. Thanks for listening. It's important to the girls in your lives that you do. The International Coalition of Girls' Schools created this series in true partnership with Two Stories, created by executive producer Carol Williams, creative producer Linda Scarborough, with audio engineering and production management by Rebecca Van Zyl. Artwork for this show by Lucia Viglietti. Thanks to all of the girls around the world who shared their voices and perspectives with us in each episode of the Connect a Girl series. For more information, please refer to the show notes.